This episode of TWIM is brought to you by Hover.com. Hover makes domain name registration and management simple. For Hover's transfer concierge service, free for our audience, go to Hover.com/TWIM. This week on the show, should Google buy the record industry? Is the FCC pickpocketing broadcasters? And can Netflix survive the frigid temperatures of Canadian broadcasting? Right here on This Week in Media, number 230. Hey everyone, welcome back to This Week in Media. This is Alex, and the publishing is going to be a little late. I just would like to say on this show how much I dislike Skype. I probably shouldn't say that on a show, but I'm going to say it anyway. We had a little issue with Skype where they changed all the rules underneath us, or underneath me. It turns out that you now, to have many people talking, you now have to pay and you have to upgrade. And I was quite happy with the version that was working, and now I have a version that doesn't really work. So anyway, so now we got that all sorted out, but it delayed our record schedule a little bit. But fortunately, we got a great crew to discuss the news of the week. Coming in from Ivoryton, Connecticut.
That's right. Ivoryton, Connecticut.
Lon Seidman. Now, how did they get the name Ivoryton?
We were once the center of the ivory trade.
Because there was a lot of elephants in Connecticut?
Apparently, pieces of them, unfortunately. We had a piano factory here, and this was like a real major hub of the ivory trade back when you could trade ivory. We don't do it anymore, though, but the elephants are still all over town.
Also coming in from San Francisco, California, Dane Golden. Hey, Dane.
Hey, Alex. Hey, Lon.
Hey, Dane.
And you are in San Francisco, right? You're not globetrotting on us.
That's right. I might be, but I'm not.
Very good. We've got a lot of good. Now, Dane, what have you been doing on your shows? You've been having Hey.com show. How did you get Hey.com?
I got it September 25th, 1995 for $50.
Jeez. That's all I got to say. Every time I look at that, I'm like, Dane has a three-letter URL, and it is a word.
It's a great word.
It's a great word. It's So how's your podcast been going?
It's going great, modifying a little bit, but also launching a brand new podcast next week.
Next week? What are you launching?
Facebook This Week.
So not This Week in Facebook, but no. Facebook This Week.
I'm calling it Facebook This Week because the initials are FTW.
For the win! Yeah.
And it's going to be a panel show. Very excited about it. Basically, you can subscribe to it on Facebook right now. But you know what? They don't allow you to create a username with the word Facebook in it.
Not that you're bitter.
So it's Facebook.
There you go.
Facebook. So it'll be fun.
So stay tuned for that. That'll be your first episode's coming out next week. So yeah. I don't really understand Facebook, so maybe I'll listen and learn.
Sometime.
I have a lot of friends on Facebook, but I don't really know what to do with it. So very good. I'm looking forward to it. I'll probably listen to it and see if I can actually figure out how it works. My kids know how it works really, really well. I'm not so good. So the first story coming up here, why Google should buy the record industry, or should Google buy the record industry? So this is coming out of Tech Dirt. Of course, we all know that Google and Apple and a lot of other people are kind of racing to try to create a cloud music service. The idea is that you can actually be able to stream stuff to your to any of your devices. Because the problem that we all have now is that I have a couple laptops, and I've got a couple iPads, and I've got iPhones, and I'm traveling all over the world, and I don't want to necessarily keep all of this on my computers because I have a big music library. So the idea is that you can put it all up somewhere and be able to just kind of stream it wherever you're at, as long as you have an internet connection. And so they've been trying to work all of this stuff out. A close source to the negotiations characterizes the search giant as quote-unquote disgusted with the labels, so much so that they are seriously considering following Amazon's lead and launching their music cloud service without label licenses. So they've just about had it. Now here's the question that TechDirt brought up. Hugh Grant at TechDirt brought up is, should they just buy the record industry? It turns out, you know, if you look at the overall market cap for these companies compared to the cash on hand for Google, Apple, Amazon, these companies, they could just buy the entire record industry without really much of a dent in their bottom line. So Dane, do you think that Google should just give up and just buy everybody?
No way. That's preposterous. I think they can go the Amazon route very easily. And Amazon's route is just brilliant for its elegance, I think.
They're just saying basically, so Amazon's route is basically, we don't need a license because this is not any different than putting music on your own hard drive. You're buying space and then you're putting it there.
That's right. Why is that any different than Dropbox?
Right. So that's their argument. Now, the issue is, so Lon, I have a question for you. Now, maybe they shouldn't buy the entire record industry, but doesn't it seem like there's all these issues between the media industry, whether it's TV or the recording industry, and the electronics industry. The electronics industry being, let's just say, slightly more modern in a lot of the ways that they're thinking. Because the media industry, to be fair, has a lot to lose. I mean, they have a business model that has made money for them for a long time, and moving away from that is scary. And it most likely in the short term could end up resulting in lower revenue. The electronics industry, of course, wants to keep on moving things forward, and they're selling hardware, they're not selling content. The real question is that does it make sense for the electronic industry to consider starting to make heavy investments into the media industry, specifically to kind of coax it down the path of righteousness, so to speak?
You know what I wonder is why isn't Apple and Google just signing artists? Especially those that are getting into the free agent status of their agreements with their record contracts, because they've got the money, they've got the distribution mechanism, and they're sick of having to pay them the licensing fee. Also, they could really just turn it into margin if they really wanted to. So that's what I'm curious about. We're seeing a lot more self publishing going on. The Radiohead album, great example of that. I think the industry is ripe for disruption, and I'm just surprised that Google and Apple haven't acted on that quicker.
Well, they had there was a Roger Ebert, who, by the way, if you're not following Roger Ebert on Twitter, you're crazy.
He's done some great stuff.
He is prolific, and he has all these great links and all. I mean, he is like the ultimate search engine for things that are interesting when it comes to the media, and but Roger Ebert had linked to an article that said, I guess last month, the top five of the top, I think it was top 20 or top 100 books being sold electronically on Amazon were self-published by one person, and he made $168,000 last year.
Yeah.
So that's the possibility. And people say, well, not everybody can do that. Well, not everyone can be successful in the movie industry or the record industry either. I mean, how many people are waitresses or waiters in L.A. thinking, someday they're going to strike it rich? So the point is that it's a lightning bolt no matter what. The question is, do you want that lightning bolt to be filtered through, an agency, or do you want direct access? And it does feel like Apple has all. I mean, they have the vertical market. I mean, they have GarageBand and but not only GarageBand, but Logic, and they have the new Final Cut coming out, and all these other things. I always have wondered. You can publish to QuickTime, to iTunes from GarageBand. You always wonder, like, when are they going to add the publish to iTunes Music Store?
Well, not just that, but where would Lady Gaga be or Justin Bieber be without YouTube, Google's YouTube?
Well, and the real question is does Lady Gaga is a perfect example of someone who totally understands her marketing. I don't think her record industry has any idea what she's doing. There are some bands, obviously, that the Pussycat Dolls or the that are kind of manufactured to some degree by a record industry, and this is the model. This is how we're going to put it together. This is what we're going to do, and they have a lot to owe to their. To their record label, because that's a package that's been put together that's been made possible. On the other side of that, though, you have someone like Lady Gaga, who is she really understands how she's doing things. She whether it seems crazy to us or not, she knows exactly what she's doing, and she does it really well. And the real question is, does she need a record? Does Lady Gaga need a record label? And did she ever?
She did to start, I think.
You think?
I think so, because you have to break through. I just subscribed to this Mog. Have you heard of Mog before? It's like RDO, that, you know, it's one of these paid subscription music services. So it's $10 a month, which is a pretty good deal. And it gives you access to like everything, and pretty high quality MP3 audio also. I'm still in my trial period. And I'm not a very cultured person, you know. I follow the space shuttle.
You listen to a lot of 38 Special, right?
Yeah, right. I'm trying to like expand my horizons here. So I subscribe to Mog, and it's got every song, new, old, and in between. And I'm lost. There is so much stuff out there, and this is independent artists. This is commercial publishers. This is everything, and it's really tough. And to break through all that noise, same problem with YouTube. I mean, you know, you just get lucky like Rebecca Black did and all of a sudden have 100 million people criticizing you every 22 seconds. But, there's a lot of stuff out there. And I think the one thing that the labels provide, and perhaps Google and Apple could do this just as easily, is that filtering, that
curation. Well, I mean,
curation,
the thing is that they're already doing that. I mean, what mm-hmm. You can talk to any app developer or anybody in the music industry or anybody in podcasting, and they'll tell you, get on that front page of you get on iTunes front page, and it is, you know, the road to, you know,
it's a golden ticket.
Yeah, it's a golden ticket.
I think you can use YouTube or iTunes or the web to launch yourself, but then you need some other traditional service, whether that is a new service that's owned by Google or whatever. But much like Amanda Hocking launched herself on Kindle as an author and now is also going to have a traditional book deal.
Well, and I think that some of that has to do with you don't want to deal with, you know, as an artist, a lot of times they don't want to deal with the business end of all of this anyway. I mean, they want to make music, and trying to figure out the ones, I think that a lot of the artists that are doing well right now are the ones that are paying attention to that. There are a lot of artists that, you know, I used to work for Sony, you know, so I used to work for Sony Music as a marketing rep. And I can tell you from experience that there are a lot of artists that I worked with. My job was to basically drive them around town, make sure they get interviews, do parties for them, that kind of thing. And there's a lot of them that are just not equipped. They're equipped to do great music. They're not equipped to do business.
By the way, I wanted to add that Sony, you know, this was years ago, of course, but Sony was a technology company that bought an entertainment company, Columbia Pictures.
Yep.
And
why did they do that?
They did it, I think, just to sell more product.
They did it as someone who worked for CBS, and then it was bought by Sony. The rumor was a lot of it had to do with DATs, you know, so there was a lot of Sony had a platform that they couldn't import into the United States because the record industry was blocking it because they were afraid you could make a perfect recording. And, I know this all sounds familiar, right? Mm-hmm. And Sony bought, Sony Music was or CBS Records and Epic Records and, you know, that group were the ones that were really focused on not allowing that to happen and blocking it in court and so on and so forth. And Sony bought them, and then all those blocks disappeared and the DATs were in the next, you know.
But as I recall, there was a huge culture conflict early on with those merging of those companies, and that is pretty similar to the idea of Google buying a music company. It's doable, but they're a technology company.
You know, I don't remember there being I was there.
Yeah.
You know, during that merger. And you know, there might have been at the top.
The press said there was.
The press said there was. As someone who was working for those companies, I mean, I was working for CBS Records, and then it was bought by Sony. And I wasn't struck with a lot of conflict, at least at the level that I was at and the people that I was dealing with. For the most part, CBS and Epic were kind of left alone. I mean, the big thing was they weren't allowed to keep on suing Sony over DAT players. But outside of that, I mean, for the most part, we still thought of ourselves as CBS Records and Epic for a long time, and we had new Sony cards. The biggest thing that the biggest thing for CBS and Epic employees was that we now got to go to they opened up the big thing was they opened up a Sony store in the new CBS building or the old CBS building or whatever, and you could buy everything for 40% of list. So and you could buy Sony had this crazy thing where you could actually not only buy everything at 40% of the list, but you could buy as much as you wanted. You could buy it for your friends.
Very nice.
It was a crazy, I don't know if they still do this, but it was like a crazy benefit. And what they looked at it as is, you know, we asked, can we really buy this for our friends? Can we just come in and buy Sony stuff? How does this work? And they said, well, you can't sell it. You can't sell it to your friend. I mean, you can't start making a business out of it. If you do that, you'll get in trouble. But otherwise, they didn't care because they saw it as Sony employees gaining influence. This is kind of a very Japanese approach to things, is that you now become the person. Everyone wanted to know a Sony rep because you knew you could get cheap home, you know, entertainment stuff. So that was a change for us. But outside of that, it was a pretty straightforward process. And it isn't so, it, you know, but Dane, the point that you bring up is that it is not a unheard of thing for an electronics company to buy a music company. And, you know, and then Sony, you know, and those worlds have largely, to be honest with you, been separate. You know, I mean, they're not as bound up. I was just at Sony Pictures a couple of weeks ago taking a course, and, you know, they don't feel like they need to necessarily buy Sony equipment. I mean, they have a lot of Sony equipment around. They get a good deal on it, but you saw a lot of other equipment there as well. It's an interesting, interaction, but it does beg the question as to whether it almost makes sense, because it almost makes sense for the hardware companies to do that. Dane, do you think that we're going to see any changes where we see electronics companies, or some of these companies starting to buy, maybe not the whole industry, but starting to buy record labels or just creating their own from scratch?
I think that Google or Apple could both do it. Not an if Apple's an electronics company, then yes, but more the iTunes division of that company. The YouTube division of Google could absolutely do something like that.
I mean,
I don't think so.
The danger for Apple would be antitrust. I mean, the problem is that because Apple has the largest sales channel in the United States, or in the world, I think, at this point, for music, buying a significant amount of the actual music industry would probably get them into a lot of hot water. But Lon, yeah. do you see any investments in this area?
I think there needs to be. They're paying out a tax for all this content now. So, there's a real disruption about to happen. We don't know exactly how it's going to transpire, but we're seeing artists being successful on their own. We're seeing consumers getting fed up of having their content locked out of different devices. I think there's definitely room for a shift here. And the question is, how does that happen? I think the industry is looking at, or the electronics industry is looking at it as safety in numbers, where if Amazon, Google, and Apple all just set up digital lockers without permission, then there's a showdown in the works that it'll be hard to shut one down individually. So I think there's something really big swirling around out there. And the article even says swirling. I think this is something we should definitely keep an eye on, and we'll see how things look over the summer here once Apple makes its inevitable announcement, and Google does too.
Also, Google is tightening the rules for copyright policies. This is according to Politico. Jennifer Martinez writes that YouTube online video users on Thursday, this is a week ago Thursday, requiring violators to watch a copyright tutorial and pass a test before allowing them to continue to use the service. So now, if you break the rules, you have to basically go to traffic school. Online traffic school of understanding what the rules are. Lon, do you think this is going to work? Is this going to cut down on copyright violation?
No, because the questions are really easy. I don't know if you heard Leo on This Week in Google. I guess he had to take the test because of it being a news organization. He was putting in fair use of certain clips that were getting dinged automatically. I think it might, but at the end of the day, the problem still remains that Google really doesn't have a good system for appeal. And as individual content providers, we're providing news. We're less likely to actually be able to do our craft, right? Because sometimes we can do something with fair use that might be automatically picked up somewhere else and might take us down and make it more difficult to communicate what we want to communicate. So I think what they need to do is put in more due process to help people make the case for a fair use of that content, number one. And number two, I think the broader issue here is how do we make this all work for everybody? I think what the music industry did right with YouTube was allowing that content to remain, and they split the revenue. That's a great solution. A lot of people aren't posting things to YouTube to make money. They just want to share something with their friends, and if it detects the song, off it goes. I've had royalty-free music get picked up, right, and I lose the revenue. Not that I'm making anything on it, but I'm losing the revenue because the royalty-free music that I put into something 20 years ago gets picked up somewhere, and I now no longer have the right to earn money off my content. I think that's it's kind of lousy. So hopefully they'll look at that and try to give content creators a little bit more leeway here in directing this.
Dane, is there a cost, a cultural cost of not of really being so, you know, basically going down so far one side? We're just simply going to take everything off. Anything that is automatically identified, there's no due process. We're going to just pull it all off. And so as a result, people who are creating things simply just avoid even fair use. Is there a cultural cost to all of that?
Well, sure. I mean, people love to be able to post whatever they want on YouTube, and that is a cultural phenomenon.
It's not just a cultural phenomenon. I mean, the reason that we have fair use is that people can use it for education. People can use pieces for, it's not necessarily just entertainment, but if they want to talk about something, if they want to show something, fair use was there to protect free speech inside of protecting copyright.
I don't think that this particular issue deals much with fair use. I think it deals with 95% of what people are posting. But, I used to help manage that account at Twit, and it wasn't, at that time, there wasn't a big issue. They would flag something, but they wouldn't necessarily take it down if there was something embedded in it. And yes, there needs to be a fair approach, which I have not been keeping up on how you do it when you're a news organization, which that's a very, very small amount of what is if you compare by total views what the copyright infringements and the people that are worried about on YouTube. But yeah, I think that there definitely needs to be a proper appeal process.
And one other thing too, Alex, that I've been noticing also is that when somebody hits the big time, right? You have that video of the tickling penguin. Did you see that one the other day? So somebody puts up this thing about this little penguin that runs over and gets tickled and starts doing the penguin equivalent of laughing. Gets on Good Morning America, 1.5 million views out the window. Everything's great. All of a sudden, people start grabbing that video and then uploading it to their own accounts. So now that video that someone should be getting all the views from on YouTube is now getting kind of dispersed amongst 5 or 6 exact duplicates of this thing on other people's accounts, presumably to maybe boost up their view rank. Yet those videos don't get taken down, right? There's no automatic
right.
thing.
Because the reason that they don't get taken down, of course, is because there's no big lawsuit waiting on the other side of that.
Exactly. And I think if they're going to be fair, then they need to be fair. And if they can apply that kind of algorithm to commercial content, then maybe they should run some of this other stuff through there as well. Because, someone who does hit it big with a great video, a friend of mine happened to have a video that got viewed 2.5 million times. And sure enough, copycats start popping up. That's real money. Maybe not $1 million for that person, but it could be $10,000 or $15,000 or more. That's the kind of thing I think Google needs to do. Staff up. And really look at making it fair for independent producers.
I wanted to add that there are some really interesting cases that come on sort of both sides of this. Someone like Keenan Cahill, I don't know if you're familiar with this kid who got famous by lip syncing, copyrighted songs. Mm-hmm. And now well-known music producers or entertainers or athletes will perform the songs with him. So now, because he's been lip syncing, now he's mainstream and they want to help him make these videos. So that's an interesting way of someone who's using, basically not using fair use, but breaking copyright, now is being co-opted by the copyright holder themselves.
Well, and I think that's an example of when I'm referring to cultural cost. That's something that's an original experience. I mean, I get that they are breaking copyright law, but the issue is because we're so careful about copyright law and we're so restrictive about it, that in general, people like you and I would not go down that path because we don't want to take any risk.
I did go down this path, though. I made a video a couple years ago fully knowing that I was infringing upon a John Williams song that I accompanied to a video of myself running a marathon at age 9. But I just thought it was a perfect thing. And sure enough, I've never got a takedown message. In fact, they've added me, to the 1 hour or longer length.
Right.
Because I have no takedown messages.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think that a lot of people like me, like I'll avoid doing anything that's going to mess with my copyright situation because I just don't.
You don't want the death penalty.
I just don't want, you know, yeah, I can't afford to have that stuff happen. But there's lots of things that we would do that would be not only, it would, oftentimes it would be good for the copyright holder. You know, if you're including, if you make a great music video, like you want to rebuild and build your own version of a music video and you want to put it up there, and it's a great way to take an old song that no one's heard for 20 years and put it up there, and then suddenly people start buying it, and that's good for the copyright holder. But there's a lot of, you know.
Rick Astley?
No, not like Rick Astley. but you know, the, you know, anyway, the point is that an average person might do that, but, you know, someone in the business won't do it because they're afraid of getting themselves caught into that web, and I think that we lose a lot of content that way. I mean, I have to admit that I think our copyright system is completely broken, so we'll just, you know, I think that completely. So, I mean, just like barely working, and I think that, you know, we're going to continue to have this kind of a lot of people doing a lot of things with it and breaking it constantly because it just doesn't make any sense anymore. It's not rational in this technology, in this level of technology. So we'll see how it goes. Before we get to the next step, we got some great stuff. We've got pickpocketing. The FCC is pickpocketing, actually. Facebook is building their own computer hardware and trying to friend journalists, and we've got all kinds of crazy stuff going on in Canada. But before we get to that, I want to thank our sponsor, Hover.com. Hover, of course, is all about making domain registration and service simple. So the key is that, you know, I don't know how many times you guys have gone up to register this great idea that you have. You think about it, and then you enter the online gauntlet, you know, the URL gauntlet. No matter what service you go to, or almost every service, you're sitting there, you know, would you like to add eggs with that, or would you like toast? Would you like, and there's like page after page after page as they try to upsell you to email and upsell you to insurance and upsell you to privacy and upsell you to all these other things. And there's just constantly this barrage. And before you know it, you're either confused and now broke, or you finally figured out how to just say no, no, no. And it's always like the tiny little words down there, like no thanks. You know, so there's these big words that say continue and pay $18.75 more. Or there's like this tiny little one hit somewhere that says, you know, no thanks, just move forward. So the idea behind Hover.com is to make that simple, make it easy, not have a lot of other services. They don't sell a ton of other services. What they focus on is, of course, a way to make it easy to register and manage your domains in your email. They have a no-hold policy, so if you call Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern, you're going to get a live person. You're not going to get put on hold. You're actually going to get to talk to someone about what the issues are that you're having with your domain. And, if you buy many URLs, and I've bought a lot, that's unusual.
So you're saying if you call, you get a person?
A person.
I don't understand.
Not like a digitized person. Evidently. So it used to happen in the past, a long time ago, when you called a company on a phone, you actually talked to a person. it was right immediately. I mean, it was this crazy thing. I mean, I know it sounds quaint.
No pressing zero, no nothing. No, you talked to a person.
You didn't have to press zero 40 times until you got through it. You didn't have to. Constantly say representative into the little voice activated thing. You didn't have to run through any hoops. You would just call and somebody would pick up the phone and say, "Hello, how can I help you?" It's something that some of you that are listening have never actually experienced because, you know, that just doesn't, you know, occur very often. But Hover is bringing back this goodie but oldie of being able to actually get on a phone and call with a problem and talk to a real person in real time about your problem so that you can actually get it handled. You can also, you know, you can set up email addresses, forward email addresses, redirect your domains to other websites, create URL extensions, set privacy controls, all with, you know, just a handful of clicks because they're not trying to upsell you on everything. So anyway, if you want to try this out, definitely check it out. So if you want, you know, go to hover.com. And go to hover.com/twim. That's hover.com/twim. You'll get 10% off if you use the offer code TWIM. So you get 10% off if you want a new domain if you just use our offer code. But you can find out all about it by just going to hover.com/twim. So definitely check that out. And thank you to Hover for supporting our little operation here. Now, back to the stories, the pickpocketing or voluntary action. So here's what's happening. This is according to Ars Technica, Matthew Laser. FCC is talking about basically looking at an issue with spectrum. So the idea is that we're all using our smartphones a lot more than we're using our radios. I mean, I think that's the bottom line. So we're using our smartphones more than we're using our radios or our over-the-air television. You know, that's another thing that some of you may not actually know is that you used to have a television that had an antenna. It was crazy. There was little rabbit ears, or sometimes you put metal on the top of your roof. So I actually ran electric fence as this huge mesh across my parents. So my parents, you know, we live in the country, and so it was hard to get reception for some of the UHF channels. And so I would actually, when I was a kid, when I was like 10 years old, I climbed on the roof with electric fence. When you grow up on a farm, you have a lot of electric fence rolls laying around because you're constantly running new lines of electric fence. It turns out they're pretty good antennas. And so, you know, I attached it to the antenna that we had, and then I ran it all over the roof where no one would see it, so that I could get Channel 53 and watch, I think at the time it was Hanna-Barbera or something like that, that I wanted to see. So so long ago, there was over the air, and it takes up, of course, certain spectrums. Carriers and regulators have been eyeing and looking at is the 300 megahertz spectrum that is mostly reserved for over-the-air television broadcasters. Now, what they're not saying they want to get rid of it. They just want to say they want to take some of it and give it to what's really using a lot of bandwidth, which is the smartphones. Of course, the broadcasters say they're being pickpocketed. This is our bandwidth, and we want to keep it, even if no one's actually using it. Lon, what do you think is going to happen here?
Well, I think there'll be a real secret behind closed door meeting, and everyone will make some money, and then the spectrum will continue.
Because that's one of the things that they're looking at is they're looking at basically almost forcibly paying the broadcasters for their loss of spectrum. So basically, you have the cell phone providers or whoever's going to buy into that buy it, and then that money goes to the broadcasters to offset the cost of all of those other pieces, and go down that path. But the FCC is kind of and Congress is kind of hinting that there won't be a lot of choice related to that.
And that could likely be the case. If they're not, you know, I think the government's going to say, look, if you're not using the spectrum, it's really important to the economy that it get used. And we're looking at a physics problem, too, that we're just running out of physical spectrum. And that's a big problem moving forward. You know, until we invent subspace communicators like Star Trek, you know, we're kind of limited to this very limited set of spectrum that we can actually use for this thing. And it also makes you wonder too, as you're seeing now in on the internet, where the IP space is beginning to dry up. In fact, Asia's out of IP addresses, and now we're seeing some of those address blocks that were never supposed to be used for global communications suddenly, you know, being reassigned for that.
I just bought 13 IPs, you know, for my house, and I have a lot of things in my house that I need to connect to. And
make sure you use them all.
Well, not only that, I had to justify each one of them. Like, I literally had to fill out a form that said what I was going to use. If I'm using this one for a server, and I'm using these ones for cameras, and I'm using this one. You know, like, I had to make a list of what they all were to say this is why I can't just buy IPs. I need to justify. I remember when I used to get Speakeasy, it was like, you know, you just get 5 IPs with your subscription.
Oh yeah, they toss them out as part of the deal. Right?
Here, kid, have some IPs.
Here, you want some more? You collect another $10. And now it's a lot different. But I think that's the same thing we're going to see with spectrum. I mean, we're all walking around now with these multi bandwidth devices that I think in the iPhone, you've got 4 or 5 different radios, a Wi-Fi, a Bluetooth, a 3G, an Edge. And there's all this spectrum that each of these little devices is using. And they've become so ubiquitous that we don't even think about how amazing it is that it can do all these things and do it so quickly. But that takes physical spectrum. So this is an ongoing issue. I'm sure it'll continue. I think the broadcasters should get something for giving up what they've paid for, because it is technically something that they've licensed from the government, from the public. But it's probably going to need to happen, because these devices need to work.
Dane, is in 10 years, are we going to be using over-the-air broadcast?
In 10 years, that's a very interesting question, because didn't we just reallocate or – They apparently call it repacking. Didn't we just do that 2 years ago?
Well, that was digital.
Right, but the digital...
But I mean, the other thing is that was digital broadcasting. So now you still have antennas that are still picking up signals, but the signals are no longer analog. They're digital, which takes up a lot less room. So that's how we were able to reallocate a lot of space, because we moved to a much more efficient way of passing that along. And that's why we had to force everybody to get digital transcoders for their antennas. But the real question is that We're going to do it. Are we going to be doing any of this at all? I mean, is the idea, are broadcasters going to become simply media providers on the internet superhighway?
Well, I think that, I think first of all, like you guys have been saying, everything's moving to IP that's any in any way connected via cable. But also, I think that television, we will not worry too much about whether it's coming over a cable box or whether it's across the broadcast, because we are going to see more things like tablets and other devices where we watch television around the house. So I think that you're going to see, or at the coffee shop or wherever. So I think you're going to see more Wi-Fi, more
content, but
3G,
but
4G, LTE, right, as the distribution method for all of this content, whether it's in your home or mobile, or at work.
So we'll have to see how that goes. Last little bit of news for that. We're going to talk a little bit about, I mean, we'll touch on these. There's actually a couple pieces to talk about here. Facebook, of course, is now, they're doing a couple things that they're trying to make friends with lots of different parts of the industry. I'm going to kind of combine two of these stories. Facebook is of course, they're partnering with a variety of tech hardware providers, Hewlett Packard, Dell, Advanced Micro, or AMD, as well as Intel, to create an open compute project. So this is designed to make it more power-efficient computers that are specifically geared towards running internet services. So the idea is forget all the internal stuff. It's basically, let's make sure that you all build really nice MacBook Airs. something that's really, doesn't have a lot of storage, but it's really, really good for the internet. Built-in, pieces like that. So Facebook's doing this one piece here. They're also friending a lot of journalists. So they're hiring someone to build relationships with reporters and news organizations. Does it seem, Lon, like Facebook is really trying to extend its influence to really affect everything that's touching it?
Oh, yeah. I think they need to. And I maybe there's a two-front battle going on here. The first, of course, is to get away from these sensational stories that often pop up about Facebook, some justified, some not, about privacy issues and other things. And clearly, Facebook has become, in a very short period of time, a major disruption in how our society communicates and shares information, not only within this nation, the United States, but other countries worldwide. And, I think to a large extent, this show gets out through that mechanism also. So I think they're trying to A, develop themselves as a little bit less of a scrappy college dorm room kind of corporation and into something more along the lines of Google that's looked at as a very serious business, which it is.
Well, I think that it's one of those things that when you have someone who's when you create an opaque situation, Apple can get away with that. But when you create something that's opaque, a lot of times people just kind of, they run off and talk about whatever they're if they don't have any contact or they don't feel like they have an inside back channel into the real information, they'll just start making up their own stuff. I know that there are some companies that I work with that if they don't give me any information, I feel much more free to just kind of make up whatever I think might be happening. If they give me the information, then I tend to be a lot more careful with it. And so
plus the way the news media works now, we're in a 10-minute news cycle. So if you don't get that comment, that story is often posted without the company side of the story. So I could see why they would do that. The hardware thing is kind of fascinating to me. I'm surprised that Facebook hasn't developed its own Facebook app for the iPad. Yet they're trying to influence how the hardware is designed. So they have
one for the iPhone, but they don't have anything for the iPad.
Yeah, which is bizarre, but maybe there's a hope here that they can get that seat at the table. I think they're largely developing the human curated web, where Google does more through algorithms and is struggling to try to catch up. Facebook has a tremendous amount of data that I think they're probably trying to figure out how to use, and having some hardware access might be a good way to tie those pieces together. But I don't see Apple doing this.
Dane, is there anything that Facebook is not going to try to touch?
Well, we'll cover that in my show, but I think that these two stories are very interesting on two sides. One, you have the open compute standard. Now, remember, a couple of years ago, Google opened up their standards for their servers, both Facebook now and Google then, designed to be very energy efficient and to share the design in order to propagate it. So, yes, I think that they are very much interested in shaping that. And then in the journalism, there's nothing more important than shaping how journalism is done, because that's the viewpoint of Facebook to the world. It's not just what your friends say Facebook is. It's what journalists do. And Facebook has traditionally been very poor about having contacts and availability to, you know, journalists, not just from commenting, but also, if you think about it, they have really no tech support. And so individuals are the tech support. Right. So that's, I think, a big issue. And if you can assuage some of that, then you're on the right track.
So we'll see how, that all turns out, of course. And you'll be covering a lot more about that on your show, Facebook, this week.
Yeah.
FTW. So we're looking forward to hearing more about that. Last story of today. This is from the Montreal Gazette. Jamie Sturgeon, talking about Canada's leading television companies are taking aim at Netflix and other online streaming services, attempting to drag the fast-growing competitive threat to the TV business into the same regulations that they are beholden to. So, you know, the issue that they have, of course, is that they're basically saying that people are able to legally operate in Canada without paying a cent of broadcast licenses and subsidy fees that finance the production of domestic content. So here's one thing that's a little bit different in Canada than it is in the United States. All of these broadcasters are paying licensing fees and subsidy funds and subsidy funds that are basically designed to fund lots of Canadian productions. And so there's actually a lot of homegrown stuff that's paid for, not necessarily, I mean, kind of by the government through proxy, but really paid for by all the broadcasters. They actually have to put money into a fund, and that fund is then reallocated to pay for all kinds of Canadian content, and it actually produces a lot of really interesting content, really diverse content, and most importantly for Canadians who live right next to the United States and speak the same language, Canadian, you know, local content, homegrown content, as opposed to just simply watching ABC and NBC, which is what they're trying to, you know, not have happen. So anyway, their upset is that they're, you know, those costs are not being shouldered by the many people who are growing to watch Netflix. Now, Lon, is this a valid complaint?
I think it's the old versus new problem that the record industry is having too, right? It's similar to that. It's a licensing fee. It's a way to try to adapt the old way of doing things to the new way of doing things. And one of the things that the record industry is dealing with, that the movie industry is dealing with, and perhaps the Canadian broadcast industry is dealing with, is that the entire overhead of distribution is so different for internet content, for Netflix in particular. I mean, they do spend a lot on bandwidth, but to do what they do the old way would be insurmountable and probably impossible. So I think this might, again, be something where if Netflix really wants to get into the Canadian market, they're probably going to have to pay up. But at the same time, the market is a lot smaller than it is in the United States, and maybe they'll look elsewhere, and perhaps Canada might favor a Canadian version of Netflix doing the same thing. But this is a problem that we're going to see everywhere. It's trying to adapt to this new content model, and it's going to have a number of bumps along the way, and I wish Netflix luck. It's not easy to deal with any government when you're regulated. So,
or any media industry. I find it funny. I had a panic last night. Netflix had reordered all of the way they deal with TV shows.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So I popped up. I have a lot of TV shows in my queue. I don't really surf TV anymore. I think a lot of us don't. A lot of us that are connected, you know, that have a good connection, you stop surfing the web. I mean, surf the web, you stop surfing TV for, like, what am I going to watch at 7 o'clock in the afternoon or 7 o'clock in the evening or whatever. You just simply, find the, you surf what's available in VOD or what's available on Netflix or, you know, and you pick what you want. And anyway, I have a lot of Law and Order and X-Files, and my wife had never seen X-Files like a year ago.
I'm
embarrassed to talk about that on a podcast, but she had never seen it, and so I introduced her to it. Now she loves it, but she doesn't call it X-Files. She just calls it, let's just watch a Mulder. But suddenly they were all gone. I mean, everything was gone, and what they did is they had compiled them all, so you just subscribe to one thing. So I suddenly thought that X-Files, and you were hearing all this news of things leaving Netflix, and I thought the X-Files and Law and Order had all been taken off of Netflix, and I was like, rah, and I was twittering about it or tweeting about it. But the reality is that there are a lot of these. So I was upset. But what I really looked at is the problem that a lot of these companies have is my initial reaction was, I'm not going to watch those anywhere else. If you take them off of Netflix, I don't want to watch them. You know, like they're dead to me. Like the shows are, if they're not on Netflix, I don't want to know about it anymore. And I don't think I'm the only person that thinks that. You know,
I'm thinking that way.
It's almost become kind of a religious thing. not a religious thing, but like a political, like, you know, I'm not going to watch these. I'm not going to pay for these somewhere else because they should be on Netflix. I saw them on Netflix. There's a lot of other things on Netflix. If I can't have them on Netflix, I don't want to play anymore. And I think that's the problem typically with freedom. You know, once freedom kind of gets out of the bag, it's really hard to, you know, put it back in. Dane, is this going to be something that can really be, can the media industry put this cap back on?
Well, I want to make a more surface comment about the fellow who's talking in this article, John Cassidy, Corus CEO. The photo of him, here's a guy in a $150 button-down shirt, $150 tie, French cuffs, and an expensive watch. And I'm looking at a photo of Reed Hastings, founder of Netflix, who wears a fleece, or he wears the Silicon Valley uniform of a button-down shirt with a T-shirt under it.
Right.
A Casio style watch. And I'm just saying, and this guy, this subheader of this article says Netflix does not pose a significant threat to its business. That's famous last words there. Guy with French cuffs saying does not pose a significant threat to his business. I don't know if Netflix is going to win in this particular arrangement, but streaming will definitely take over Canada just as it is here. And by the way, I want to add my discovery of the year on Hulu Plus.
That was your discovery of the year?
I want to talk about it.
What's your discovery of the year? Go ahead.
The British comedy show Green Wing.
Green Wing.
Green Wing. I got to look that one up.
Please watch this show. It's the funniest show I've ever seen.
Okay.
Is it on Netflix?
No, it's not.
I'm not going to watch it.
Yeah,
it's on Hulu and partially Hulu Plus.
Yeah, it's like, it's not on Netflix. Well, so what's funny is that I have an Apple TV, and the only thing we use on the Apple TV 2, we have two of them, one for each of the televisions, and the only thing we use is we don't buy anything on iTunes. We're like, yeah, right. We stream our music from our media server, and we use it for playing slideshows on the TVs, and we watch Netflix. Those are the three. You know, there's a lot of other options with the Apple TV, but those are the only things we're using it for.
And the big update on the Apple TV also, now you can do the Dolby Digital audio. So we're one step closer to a real alternative to a Blu-ray rental.
And I have to admit, I just still have the speakers in the TV.
That surprises me. I thought you'd have a whole rig going on that.
Here's the funny thing is that I used to have a really big system. And I think that there has been this dumbing down of media that has been happening as a result of a lot of the online pieces. So MP3s from CDs that were coming down from records. And I think that there's a certain level of you watch the content. For me, you know, I watch content in so many different forms. I watch movies on my iPhone and iPad and laptop and on the TVs a lot of the setup around them doesn't mean as much to me anymore. And I don't think I'm the only one. I mean, I don't use this as an example of me, but just like I notice a lot of people that I know, you know, the big stereo systems that I used to see, every friend that I had used to have a really, really high-end system that they really tweaked a lot. And I just don't see a lot of those anymore. You know, I see a lot of people that are kind of happy with, you know, a couple speakers, you know, and, you know, that's enough. And I think about it. I think about building a little theater. But I just, you know, my day to day, I just kind of play the music. It's like, it's fine. I also can't play it that loud anyway because I have two little kids. You know,
and yeah, my wife yells at me now too. It's just not easy being a married man. You know,
I mean, last night we were watching Law Abiding Citizen. You can't really watch that loudly when your kids are sleeping because
right.
You know, a lot of people screaming. And so anyway, hey Lon, where can people find you?
People can find me on Twitter at LONSEIDMAN. We're doing some really cool independent media work in Connecticut, so follow me on that. I'll keep everybody up to date. We're doing some hyper-local tech news. We're retooling localonlinenews.tv to be a more regional video provider, so we're looking for people to help us with some of that stuff and maybe start some of your own things as well, and we'll help earn some revenue in the process. So look me up, and we'd love to hear from you.
And Dane, where can people find you?
People can just Google the word "hey." I come up first.
Wow, that is awesome.
How does do it?
And soon, Facebook this week. 3 O's on Facebook.com. Just search for Facebook this week.
All right, this message that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out. This Week in Media is a Pixelcore.tv production produced by Suzanne Llewellyn with technical producers John Riley and Alutha Jamankar. Content contributor is Jason Perrier.